This is Clinical Conversations' 125th podcast. It comes to you from Journal Watch, the literature surveillance service whose website is at jwatch.org. It's July 8th, 2011. Dr. Danielle Schurer of Physicians First Watch and the Medical University of South Carolina is here. I'm Joe Elia. The apparent hazards of the smoking cessation drug varenicline, known commercially as Chantix, is our topic today. We discuss a Canadian Medical Association journal study published online earlier this week with its first author, Dr. Sonal Singh. Dr. Singh and his co-authors did a meta-analysis of 14 randomized controlled trials comparing varenicline with placebo in over 8,000 subjects. They were investigating possible adverse cardiovascular effects of the drug, and they found an increased risk associated with varenicline. The absolute risk for a serious event, or serious cardiovascular event, among users of varenicline, they found, was 1.06% versus 0.82% with placebo. Dr. Singh has kindly agreed to be our guest today. He is in the Department of Medicine at Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine in Baltimore. Welcome, Dr. Singh.
Thank you, Danielle. Thank you, Joe, for having me here.
This isn't the first time that Chantix has been suspected of causing problems. What led you to undertake the study?
Actually, we have been looking at this for a while, and, you know, 3 years ago, one of my colleagues, Dr. Spangler, who's a tobacco researcher, you know, had some patients coming in with these symptoms and, you know, was also seeing a signal in some clinical trials of Chantix. Hmm. So he asked me to sort of, you know, start looking at this in a more systematic way, and that's why we did the systematic review.
And a New York Times article on your research quotes a Pfizer statement criticizing your study. Primarily the criticism was that it was, you know, the conclusions were based on a relatively small number of absolute number of events. Sure. And then in addition to that, there's an editorial also criticized your study, not so much your study, but the individual trials that went into your meta-analysis.
Sure.
The main two being, one, that the placebo group dropout rate was higher than the treatment group rates, and then the second being that a lot of these, 13 out of the 14 studies, that the cardiovascular outcomes were not adjudicated, meaning that no one had a really firm definition or validated that an event had occurred. So what is your response to those criticisms?
And, you know, those criticisms we have to look at what is the question we are trying to answer. We are trying to answer the question whether varenicline is associated with cardiovascular risk and what is the best source of evidence we have. Since we don't have an adequately powered randomized trial that, you know, assessed these cardiovascular risks of varenicline, the best trial was the Rigotti study, which also did go into a meta-analysis and adjudicated events and also found an increased risk. You know, you have to look at what the data you have. I wish we had, you know, 50,000 patients. But unfortunately, the way, you know, drugs are approved in this country and the drugs are tested, they are approved in short-term 12, 24-week studies which test 400 patients. So if we added up all the studies that are available, you know, that's what you have. And that's what the data we have to live with. And that's why we saw 72% increased risk. But, you know, the risk ratios are imprecise. You know, they range from 1.07 to... So, you know, I'm not trying to, you know, say that those, that, you know, the small number of events. Well, those are the events. And interestingly, those are the events that Pfizer criticized, but the FDA and Pfizer sat on this for 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
So they can, you know, they can criticize the absolute number. Obviously, we put it in there in the paper. And but it's still, no matter how you look at it, you look at one single trial which adjudicated events, you see an increased risk among smokers with heart disease, you see the 13 trials, and without people with heart disease, you still see an increased risk. So you can quibble about the numbers, you know, at 70% or 60%. There is an increased risk. And whether, you know, you frame it in terms of absolute, I think that's sort of an interpretation issue. I don't want to interpret my information. I think our job as scientists is to report it and, you know, let everybody interpret it differently. Taylor Hayes is interpreting it as, okay, there's a small absolute risk. There's a benefit of smoking cessation. He's right. And the benefits of smoking cessation, immediate, at least in 1 year, myocardial infarction benefit.
Right.
Here, we are seeing an increase. That means this drug is so harmful that it's overcoming that benefit. I mean, that's my argument. never seen a Chantix long-term trial showing reduced mortality or reduced cardiovascular risk. If they do that study, you know, I'll change my mind. I'll write the editorial saying, yes, it should be used. But let's see that study.
And then, and for our readers, just so they have a good understanding of this, what is the proposed mechanism for increasing this risk?
And I'll tell you, you know, exactly. I mean, to be honest, I don't know the exact answer because, you know, these issues should have been sort of brought up when it was approved and, you know, tested. And I mean, I'm sort of a clinical epidemiologist. I think these are thrombotic events. So this is a thrombotic, just like a nicotine, you know, these are all thrombotic events. And, for example, in a serious cardiovascular composite, we did count heart failure and arrhythmias, but, you know, sort of because that's what our protocol stated. But, you know, I'm not sure all these events are, but, you know, whatever you look at, the thrombotic events, that's where the real action is. And we have all the data in our paper for people to look at, you know, if they want.
You mentioned during your comments that Dr. Hayes, that Dr. Hayes is the, just so that our listeners will understand, is the guy who wrote the...
Taylor Hayes at Mayo Clinic, Minnesota.
Right. He wrote the editorial that accompanied the CMAJ paper. I wanted to ask you, as I was looking through the paper and I was looking through the methodology, I noticed that there is there are 9 studies that were excluded. And they were excluded because, according to the figure, there were no serious cardiovascular events or deaths. Why were those studies excluded, Dr. Singh?
Yeah, they were excluded because, you know, because in a relative risk meta-analysis, there is no way to incorporate studies which have zero events in both arms because they don't contribute to the relative risk estimate.
Okay, exactly.
It's for modeling reasons. So we looked for those studies. So in our search, we did try to find those studies. These are not very small studies, so, you know, I don't think the results either way, but we looked for those studies, and they did not, you know, they reported no cardiovascular events in both arms. So there is no way to model that data, and that's the reason. It's sort of a methods issue.
Right, but when you're doing a meta-analysis, if one arm is much larger than the other, say if, you know, the people taking varenicline were 5 million and there were 100 people on placebo, that would make a difference. But I just wanted to make sure that we had all of the numbers were adding up. That's why I asked the question. Okay, well, there seems to be a trade-off here. I mean, you cite one estimate. It's not your estimate, but you quote the estimate of the number of patients needed to treat with Chantix to result in one patient quitting is 10. And yet the number needed to treat, or number needed to harm, rather, to be treated to harm to sustain one serious cardiovascular event is only about 3 times as high. And I think you said earlier this is and the effect is more immediate than continuing smoking. So is that a worthy trade-off in your mind? I mean, what have your colleagues said to you about your findings?
Yeah, I mean, that's, you know, I'm a clinician, I'm an internist, I see patients this morning. We do trade-offs all the time. And remember, just to clarify, that number needed to harm actually applies to smokers with heart disease, you know. So it will be much higher for smokers without heart disease. We didn't put it in the paper because of space limitations, but it would be around, you know, 170. So sort of, you know, we could only report certain numbers. So it really depends on the trade-off, but remember, we have to think about the quitting smoking. What is the benefit outcome we have? We know we have data on abstinence. We don't have heart outcome health benefit data. So in my mind, smoking is now a chronic disease, and, you know, smokers quit, they again start smoking. So we sort of have to start thinking about smoking as a chronic disease and sort of start thinking about smoking cessation alternatives which offer health benefits, not just abstinence.
And so based on this, you being a clinician yourself, it's sort of hard to wrap your mind around, even after reading the article and reading the editorial, sort of, okay, well, so what do I do? Yeah. What do I do now? What do I do tomorrow? What do I do the next, still smoking patient? Because, the drug, it certainly is, and I sort of put this in quotes, I mean, the drug is effective in the sense that it does double the chance of successfully quitting, at least short term.
Sure.
So I guess the question is there at least some subgroup of patients that you can confidently say yourself, this I'm going to start this drug because I feel pretty good that the benefit of them stopping smoking is better than the risk of them having an event. So,
sure.
You know, young, healthy guys without cardiovascular disease, for example, yeah. Is there some group of patients that you still feel pretty good that could, despite these, and we haven't even touched on the neuropsychiatric stuff.
Yeah, I mean, that is the real. Sure.
Getting on the cardiac side of things. Is there some group of patients that you can still, that, you know, even because you've looked at this more carefully than probably anybody, that you can feel good as a clinical doctor putting a patient on drugs?
Yeah, so, I mean, that sort of goes to the benefit and risk part. And in my mind, you know, even in the cardiovascular risk, we looked at it. We looked at smokers without heart disease, and the risk ratios are same. You know, they are a little higher, but, you know, it's sort of same in my mind. But as you say, it is effective, and we know it's more effective than placebo. It's probably more effective than Zyban. I don't know if it's more effective than nicotine replacement therapy, because the only long-term trial that has assessed this, that is Aubaine, which was in a meta-analysis, really found that at 1 year, both were equivalent. So sort of I see that in the gradient of efficacy of varenicline, it's more efficacious than, you know, placebo and Zyban. I don't know if it's more effective than sort of nicotine replacement. You know, that's, I haven't seen. The other I haven't seen is that how effective is it in real clinical practice? You know, the clinical trials of varenicline used 18 and 24 counseling sessions. Which, you know, PCP or clinician sort of has that luxury? In our practice.
Right.
So what is the real-world effectiveness of not only varenicline but other smoking cessation therapies? Really not known. So, you know, I it's sort of we are making decisions based on, you know, incomplete information. We do that all the time. So there is probably, I would think in my mind, you know, I'm not, you know, saying, well, it's off the market. I mean, I think there's sort of a niche audience for these drugs, which are powerful but also toxic, you know, whether it's the hardcore smoker that has tried to quit with Zyban and not nicotine replacement, and, you know, has not gotten, and so, you know, whether if they especially don't have neuropsychiatric and cardiac patients, I think, you know, people, they should be informed, and then if they make that decision. Whether it should be the first-line drug of therapy, as other people think, I don't know. You know, I just present data. I sort of leave it at that and let people, you know, figure out and fight over it. Yeah, I mean, I can't make rest then. You know, it's sort of, and remember, we are talking about a benefit on abstinence. We've not seen long-term data on cardiovascular events or mortality. For example, for nicotine replacement, we have that data. Not because, you know, the sponsor did the study, but, you know, there were lung health study which looked at sort of, you know, long smoking cessation, and they use nicotine gum. And whether you extrapolate, can you extrapolate that to Chantix? Some people do. And we did that for diabetes drugs. You know, we sort of assumed benefit because of glucose reduction, but then we found out that for different classes it was different. So it matters what agent you use. So it's sort of where you're in that camp. Are you willing to extrapolate a, you know, benefit on sort of hard health benefit from other outcomes to Chantix? Then, you know, you can, I think it depends on which camp you're in.
Have you, I suspect I know the answer to this, Dr. Singh, but so have you changed your own recommendations to your patients about how to quit smoking?
Yes, I have. Yeah, and I was using Chantix until last year. And you know, at that time, we sort of knew about the dreams and all the neuropsychiatric. But after seeing the cardiac data, I was using it as first line, actually. Sort of, you know, gave. But, I haven't used it in the last couple of months, but I feel that sort of maybe there is this hardcore sort of nicotine. And I think it's since it's a powerful agent, you know, some of these hardcore smokers who are really smoking a lot and then don't have cardiac issues, don't have the neuropsychiatric, and then sort of you can follow them up for. I mean, the other reason we did our studies, sort of patients need to be followed up for if they have chest pain or if they have, you know, cardiac issues after thing. You know, sort of, I think smoking was a risk factor. We add one more now. They were on a drug. I mean, I got a call from South Carolina. Somebody said they saw a patient with, you know, some thrombosis. And so I think people sort of be aware that these medicines also have adverse effects.
No, that was great. Very helpful.
Okay. Yeah. Thanks so much, Dr. Singh, for spending the time with us today. And
okay. Take care. Have a good day.
You too.
Excellent. Thank you so much.
Bye-bye.
That's it for Conversation 125. Earlier podcasts are all available and all freely available at podcasts.jwatch.org. Clinical Conversations executive producer is Adoriano. I'm Joe Elia. Join us next time. For myself and Dr. Danielle Scherer, thanks for listening.